Chapter 10, The Real Budget and How to Build It, The Importance of Time, Energy, Money, and Emotion. Kids playing baseball are great, a textbook in human psychology. What happens when youngsters hit a ground ball? First, they run toward first base, or sometimes they head for third base, but let's assume they do run in the right direction. What else is happening? Often, they look over at the coach for approval, then watch the ball, then look as the shortstop catches the ball, then watch the throw. The trained little leaguers would duck their heads and run full speed to first base, concentrating on the base. This is the proper behavioral goal, but kids usually don't do this. By watching the action in the field, they run more slowly and greatly increase the chance that the ball will beat them to the bag. And often, the runner's fear of making an out takes over. The kid slows down or even quits running and looks at the coach again, thinking the throw will be in time, forgetting that the first baseman may drop the ball, quite possible, or be pulled off the bag by a higher wide throw, very possible. In short, the hitter's behavior and activity are not disciplined, and proper habits have not been developed. That run to first base is not valid. Kids are kids. They say and do the darndest things. What's really amazing is that we adults exhibit the same failing. When I was a youngster, my whole family enjoyed watching an old game show called Beat the Clock with Bud Collier as the host. He was the Regis Philbin of that era, I guess. The idea of the show was that contestants ran around the studio trying to beat the clock in the accomplishment of some ridiculous task. For some strange reason, I got to thinking about Beat the Clock years later, and I realized that we, the audience, focused on the clock, while we should have been watching the contestants' activity and behavior. Worse, the contestants were always looking up to see how much time they had remaining. But this shouldn't have mattered. They were working as fast as they could, weren't they? If they beat the clock, they beat it. If they didn't, they didn't. Watching the clock only slowed them down and made it more likely that they would not beat the clock. Bottom line, usually it wasn't the clock that beat them. They beat themselves with what I call invalid behavior. I've seen such self-defeating behavior on the other side of the table so many times it's ridiculous. 9 times out of 10, 99 out of 100, I'm tempted to say, unsuccessful negotiators have beat themselves. It's been said that my entire system is set up as a guide to behavior, and I don't quarrel with this assessment. The fuels of the system are certainly guides to behavior, specific, concrete do's and do nots, right down to choosing which words you should use when asking questions. And being un-okay, not needing, blank slating, painting pain, these are all principles of valid behavior. The subject of this chapter, budget, is another principle directed at the same purpose. As with pain, budget in my system is almost a technical term. It is much more than your normal budget, much more than an itemization of projected costs, because the real price to be paid in the negotiation goes way beyond dollars and cents. Budget in the CAMP system breaks down into three budgets that help us account for and control this real price in time and energy, money, and emotional investment. I unite time and energy because it's hard to spend one without spending the other as well. The overall budget is a comprehensive, powerful tool, another means by which we can retain control in the negotiation by making certain that our investments are working for us, not against us. Only the money budget is numerical. The other two employ a different kind of assessment, but one that we can keep up with quite accurately. My rough-and-ready formula for calculating the overall budget for a negotiation gives time a value of X, energy 2X, money 3X, and emotion 4X. Obviously, these are not empirically based numbers. They're a way to drive home the point of relative importance. If you're spending only time and energy in a negotiation, you have a budget of 1X times 2X for a total budget of 2X. If you start throwing real money around, your budget is 2x times 3x, or 6x. The real budget has tripled over the budget for time and energy alone. But what happens if your emotions enter the negotiation and the equation in a powerful way? Multiply that 6x by 4x. You're up to 24x, a large relative number that serves mainly to demonstrate how important the budget for emotion is. how dangerous emotional investment is. To repeat, budget is the way you keep on top of the real price to be paid in the negotiation, which goes way beyond dollars and cents. Both sides in a negotiation have a budget for each of these three categories, and your job is to make certain that you know both yours and your adversary's. Budget is a warning, in effect, to take careful account of factors that are usually overlooked in a negotiation and to realize their importance, and it's a way to help you use these factors to your advantage in a negotiation. Needless to say, we want to keep our own budgets as low as possible while reaping the benefits of the adversary's higher budgets. At all times, the real price we're prepared to pay is regulated by effective decision-making based on our mission and purpose and on our vision of the negotiation. The danger is that we become over-invested in a negotiation and our decision-making goes out of whack. We start thinking in such terms as, well, we've already invested so much in this deal, we have to get something out of it. That's the classic logic that yields bad deals. It's the kind of logic that seduces us into egregiously violating our mission and purpose. I don't know of a better example of what can happen when we let our sense of a maxed-out budget affect our enforcement of mission and purpose than NASA's decisions prior to the Challenger tragedy. The agency knew about the O-ring problem, but its budget for the space shuttle project was already so high that it compromised its values, its mission and purpose, and its people. The Challenger disaster was a human tragedy. You'll be dealing with situations of less import, thank goodness. But bad decision-making from budgets gone awry is what we want to avoid by knowing and setting budgets in the first place. The time and energy budget. When was the last time someone asked, "May I have a few minutes of your time?" and you granted this person the time? This was basic courtesy, but by doing so, you unwittingly placed little or no value on those minutes, correct? And if enough such unsolicited, unwanted, time-eating episodes pile up in the day, answering email may come to mind for many of us, it does for me, a considerable amount of time is down the drain by day's end. Professional negotiators must carefully consider the value of our time, but usually this calculation just doesn't enter our minds. By signing this application, all you're doing is making an application, and once it's been approved, you can decide if you want the policy. Of course, this doesn't mean you're committed. It only means you're making application. Okay, fine. I'll call to tell you when your doctor's appointment is scheduled for your physical. It won't take long. You'll be in and out of there in no time. Well, I'm going to be pretty busy for the next few weeks. Call me and we'll see if we can work it out. And the chase is on for this life insurance salesman. How many calls will it take to get the adversary to the doctor? How much work goes into application preparation and underwriting? The salesman must think about this. To the untrained negotiator, time is a virtually free commodity, given away right and left, so he ends up spending his commission, in effect, in time and energy. Do we really have much time to spare? No. Warren Buffett may have all the money in the world, but he doesn't have any more time than you and I do. And believe me, Warren Buffett understands this. I don't imagine he hands out appointments right and left. In any negotiation, the calculation of time must enter our minds, because the time at our disposal and at our adversary's disposal is so fleeting and so finite. Maybe we don't like to focus on the limited hours of the day because we don't like to focus on the limited days of our lives. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But I do know that as negotiators, we must train ourselves to care about the hours of the day. We must understand that time can be used against us in many ways, especially as a way to increase the real price of a negotiation and eventually bring about a possible compromise. All of a sudden, we're saying to ourselves, "I've got too much time in this. I can't turn away now." For the crafty negotiator, increasing the adversary's time budget is the oldest game in the book, making you wait an hour, flooding you with emails and faxes, asking you to drive 2 hours or fly 8 hours, canceling at the last minute, or arguing for 9 months about the shape of the negotiating table, which is what Ho Chi Minh's team did in the 1974 Paris peace negotiations, driving up Nixon and Kissinger's time budget. The North Vietnamese had all the time in the world for this negotiation. After all, they'd already been fighting France or us for a generation, and they knew that Nixon and Kissinger did not. Such budget-building ploys are transparent. Others are not. The use of time against you can start with something as common as you're trying to get an appointment. Just give me 10 minutes and let me show you what I've got, Sarah. Okay, when? You've got the appointment. Your company has been trying for years to open the golden door, and you've finally succeeded. But then, your adversary is a no-show. You're stood up. No explanation, no phone call, no insincere apology. The untrained negotiator now crashes, thinking that valuable time has been wasted. But what if Sarah keeps the appointment? Look how she can still use time against you. Okay, show me what you've got, but remember, I have to leave soon. The untrained negotiator gets excited and starts talking and spills every feature and benefit of his position, thinking, I'm really getting my money's worth out of these 10 minutes. No, he's not. The adversary is getting her money's worth out of these 10 minutes, because she's finding out everything she wants to know. Meanwhile, the untrained negotiator isn't finding out anything. He's violating every rule in my system. He's out of control, not asking good questions, not blank slating, not living in the adversary's world. And he is trying to close this deal today. He's chasing time, as I like to put it. Just a little more time, and they'll buy. Nothing could be further from the truth. Never chase time. For the man or woman in straight sales, conventional wisdom tells you just to get out there and make proposals, get in front of people and spill your guts, then ask them to buy. In effect, play a numbers game. Make up for self-defeating behavior with raw numbers. 100 lines in the water must be better than 5. Okay, you may catch a few small fry this way if you have the energy and the self-image to withstand the pounding. Recommended viewing, Death of a Salesman, the Lee J. Cobb performance. But you will never come close to your full potential. Why throw up a 3-pointer with 2 defenders hanging all over you? Why throw a long pass into 2-man coverage downfield? Why swing at pitches that aren't in the strike zone? Why try to carry the lake at 220 yards? Why drive to an appointment an hour away without knowing your chances for valid negotiation are good? In the discussion about warm calls versus cold calls in Chapter 1, when I was warning about the danger of the former and the surprising benefit of the latter, I was dealing with telephone calls. Never drive around town on cold calls. The great negotiator in any field won't walk next door, much less get in her car or on the airplane, without a clear picture of the negotiation coming up, a clear picture of the adversary's pain, and a firm knowledge that the adversary has the budgets in time and energy, money, and emotion to pay, negotiate, to have this pain taken away. This is the only valid appointment for the man or woman in straight sales, and the rule applies just as stringently to corporate and all other negotiators, no matter what the field. It applies also to advertising. The following paragraph on that subject may seem like a digression, but I think not. I think it drives home the point about valid appointments of any sort very well. Every morning, all of us wake up to advertising. In the newspaper, surfing the web, on television, in the mail, on the radio, on the billboards, on the magazine jackets in the airplane, on the ticket jackets for the airline, on paper coffee cups, advertising is literally everywhere. It is certainly one of our greatest commercial strengths in the United States, but how should you use advertising to do business? I once had a student who had 100,000 coupons delivered to homes each month, costing a nickel a coupon, $60,000 per year. He earned from $225,000 to $360,000 gross revenue from those coupons. Then an advertising rep presented him with a campaign to cut his advertising budget in half using the newspaper instead of coupons. When my student asked my advice, I asked a question of my own, several of them, in fact, and interrogative led, naturally, since I was trying to build his vision. What is the circulation of the local paper? I asked. He didn't know, but soon found out it was 68,000. Who are you selling to? Jim, that's easy. Working families who own their own homes. How many working families get the newspaper each day at home? He didn't know. But even if every subscriber to the newspaper was a working-class homeowner, the total was 68,000, considerably fewer than the 100,000 coupons he put in circulation. When you're at work, do you buy from newspaper advertising? Well, come to think of it, no, I don't. What do you think you should do? Maybe I need to do more research, and maybe I'd better not cut out the coupon campaign. I recommend David Ogilvy's book, Ogilvy on Advertising. It's all there. The principles of advertising as a sales prospecting tool are simple, and they pertain to many of the negotiations we're discussing in this book as well. No matter how good an appointment or meeting looks or sounds at first blush, it must meet the criteria of validity. If it doesn't offer the prospect of producing results you can measure, it has to go. Let me just repeat what I said earlier. The great negotiator in any field must not lift a finger without a clear picture of the negotiation coming up, a clear picture of the adversary's pain, and a firm knowledge that the adversary has the budgets in time and energy, money and emotion to pay, negotiate, to have this pain taken away. You'll be able to uncover budget easily when you come to understand, from trial and error, the risk to the negotiation if budget isn't solidly understood and in the open. This doesn't mean that your adversary will necessarily tell you straight out about their budgets, although he might, unthinkingly. Mainly, you'll learn to discover budget as your adversary shares his vision of his pain. The higher the pain, the higher the budget. People will pay a much higher price than you would ever ask. Bill, what would you budget to solve this problem? John, I'm not sure what it takes in dollars and cents, but with your help, we'll build the necessary budget. I'm not saying that every appointment or meeting must pan out or make progress or it becomes in retrospect invalid. Not at all. You have no control over that ultimate result. I've already related the story of my clients who flew to Ireland and were stood up. That was nevertheless a perfectly valid meeting within the ongoing negotiation. Being stood up is annoying, but it happens, and it's not the end of the world. It becomes a problem only if you crash emotionally and thereby concede leverage in the negotiation to your adversary. As I've mentioned, my stood-up clients got back on the next flight home from Ireland and a couple of days later wrote a calm letter suggesting a meeting over here the next time, and they got it. When stood up by anyone, the trained negotiator should calmly sit back and figure out whether he'd like to try again or just fade away. He should, in short, consult his budget for time and energy. This is not a specific number of hours, in all likelihood, although it could be. It's a sense, an assessment, a judgment based on experience. It is, most of all, an awareness that your time and energy is not free. The negotiator needs to remember that the adversary's budget is going up right along with his own. Patience, my friend. Always patience. That's the watchword. When someone tries to drive time up on you, regardless of how, patience will be your sword. And with a solid mission and purpose in place, he or she won't be able to drive up time. By definition, your mission and purpose is a long-term aim, a continuing task and responsibility. Therefore, time actually becomes your ally. It's there to work for you, not to run out on you. Budgeting time is a matter of disciplining ourselves, of maintaining patience, of following our mission and purpose with dedication and skill. If these are handled well, the time on the calendar question takes care of itself. Time can be wasted in a one-hour negotiation. It can be utilized to the fullest in a one-year negotiation. Time spent tells us nothing either way about time well spent. When people try to drive up your budget by putting deadlines in place, even if it's only a 10-minute time limit for a presentation, with patience and a mission and purpose, you can eagerly embrace such a deadline and craft your presentation accordingly. Every minute of your time in a negotiation is a minute of their time as well. Two can play that game. Bill, what day are you looking at on your calendar? Well, John, this is a real problem. Could you make it today? Bill, I can't get there until tomorrow. What time would be best for you? If you're using time well, you're always building your adversary's budget. You can build it with canceled meetings of your own, with urgent phone calls that you don't return immediately, by not leaving detailed messages that might save the adversary time but cost you time, or even by putting your adversary on hold for 15 seconds. I'm thinking of one particular episode when I mentioned that last scenario. In a 6-month-long negotiation, a client received a call from the adversary who wanted to review a letter my client had sent him. Even though the letter was on my client's desk, staring him in the face, he told the adversary he'd have to put him on hold and go look for the letter. Only 15 seconds. But if you're worried about an issue, 15 seconds is long enough for all kinds of thoughts to race through your mind. Meanwhile, those brief seconds gave my client time to collect and calm himself for the discussion to follow. My client was also making a subtle statement that he was not needy here, that he didn't even have the letter in front of him. Is building the adversary's budget just silly gamesmanship? Not at all. It's a valuable way to get your opponent's attention, to push their vision of their pain. Adversaries dally, play games of their own, and in many other ways simply aren't serious. These folks need your help in order to push forward to serious decision-making. One way you do this is by building their budgets, which then focus the attention marvelously. Ho Chi Minh just kept building and building and building the Americans' time budget in Vietnam until we finally figured out that the war was never going away. Think about it. Building our time budget was the best way the North Vietnamese had to get us to see the ultimate pain of our position, which was that this war was never going away. No, building budgets definitely is not gamesmanship. It's integral to painting the pain for the adversary and getting the adversary to get a clear vision as quickly as possible. In a phrase, time intensifies pain. As the investment of time mounts higher and higher, so does the psychological pressure. Many negotiators allow themselves to get the sense that they're under a deadline, beyond which they've wasted their time. My clients love to hear from the other side, "Okay, let's cut to the chase," because this may mean that the time and energy budget for the adversary is reaching its allotted total, and that they're seeing the pain very, very clearly, and that they're finally just about willing and able to make an effective decision. For your own part, make certain that you do have all the time in the world, and if you don't, be ready to walk away. Remember, you only want this deal. You do not need this deal. They may now need this deal. Crucial difference. As I've said, in a negotiation between two camp system adversaries, there's little need for budget-building tactics, because both parties are trained to move quickly to the essential issues, the essential vision, the essential pain, the essential decisions. All time is energy, of course, but in tough negotiations there may be energy spent beyond time. The work of negotiating is draining, and we really don't have any energy to waste. We want it to be there for us when we can use it the most. Never underestimate the energy that's going to be required to do a deal. Keeping our needs in check and completing the activity and behavioral goals we set will help us conserve our own energy and waste theirs. Invalid, pointless appointments and meetings? A waste of energy. Accepting maybe for an answer? A waste of energy. Accepting yes for an answer? A waste of energy. Asking questions that don't do you any good? A waste of energy. Failing to blank slate, making assumptions instead of doing valid research? A waste of energy. Needing something? A terrible waste of energy. On the other hand, the old adage, penny wise, pound foolish, is right on. We do want to spend energy in preparation and research, but the shocking reality is that many people won't or don't prepare for negotiations. They won't spend the time or the energy required. This isn't conserving energy, this is laziness, which inevitably wastes energy at a later stage of the negotiation. As I've said, my clients are often shocked by the poor preparation of some Fortune 100 companies. My system can be described as nothing more or less than a way to behave in negotiations, but it can also be looked at as a way to save energy. If our energy is wasted, it's of our own doing. We cannot blame the adversary because we're in control of our own behavior. Most well-trained adversaries will try to use energy against you, whether they would put up their actions in these terms or not. But if you're stood up, for example, exactly how much energy over and above the time that's wasted is under your control. And you can respond in kind, of course. Build their energy budget. Increase the preparation required by the adversary to complete the deal. This just doesn't make sense to us. Can you redo it? Tactically withhold decision makers from negotiation. We've talked this over and decided that your team needs to go to New York to show this to Mr. Smith. Always be guided by your mission and purpose. Be aware of personal health and stamina. Know your endurance limits. Don't get caught short of energy with jet lag. Regular physical exercise is important. Don't allow yourself to be locked away during negotiations. Take breaks and walks to keep the energy up and the head clear. Alcohol can steal your energy. Beware of social gatherings combined with business. How many times have you read about a big labor conflict that was finally resolved at 4 a.m? That's because when we get tired, we become impatient and more vulnerable. After days, weeks, maybe months of negotiations, all sides finally decide to stay with it until they have a deal, each trying to wear down the other side. The physically stronger, more energetic side gets the best of the deal. Any marathon negotiation turns into a contest of endurance, plain and simple. You must know your own endurance and not hesitate to call a timeout, whether you're in an hour-long meeting or a round-the-clock negotiation. The money budget. Put your money where your mouth is. It always seems to come down to money, doesn't it? Or as some wise person once said, when they say it's not about the money, it's about the money. Once you and your adversary start spending real money during the negotiation and get serious about exchanging much more when the deal is signed, the value of any negotiation goes up dramatically. Remember, time is 1x, energy 2x, and money 3x, roughly and relatively speaking. The value of anything goes up when money's involved. Who's more likely to attend and get the most out of seminars or classes? The student who works from midnight to 4 a.m. to pay her fees, or the student on the athletic scholarship, with free tutors and 5 years to finish at no cost at all? Who's more likely to work at the new negotiation system? The student who pays his way because he's genuinely interested and ambitious, or the employee sent by her boss? I know that answer, and so do you. Within the context of a negotiation, money is a surprisingly slippery commodity. Any given sum means different things to different people. On the most obvious level, an unexpected $1,000 expense affects the clerk earning $20,000 far differently than it affects the executive earning $120,000, and it registers differently with each of them. Less obviously, perhaps, a consumer may not be able to see value if the price of a given product is too low in his frame of reference. On the other hand, he'll search for value if the price is deemed high. A classic case is Callaway's Big Bertha Golf Club. Eli Callaway intentionally jacked up the price of this club when he first introduced it years ago, setting it far above the industrial standard and far above what he needed to make a good profit. As a marketing man, he understood that at a lower price, the Big Bertha would have been just another golf club, and the well-heeled target market wouldn't have been able to see the value. But the $400 driver, initially, even more now, caught the attention of golfers who then searched for value and found it, as any golfer who has tried the club will attest. The Big Bertha changed the industry. Just as with time and energy, you want money to work for you and against your adversary. You'll try to drive up your adversary's budget by making the negotiation literally expensive. And your adversary will try to do the same, because everyone knows that a money squeeze is often followed by compromise if the untrained negotiator loses sight of his mission and purpose. You have to know your actual dollars and cents budget for this negotiation, and you have to have a sense for their dollars and cents budget, and a sense of how they stand financially. What is your adversary's frame of reference? What's real money to them? If you're constrained by money and your adversary is not, watch out. I guess the most obvious example of this situation is a lawsuit between a lawyer representing a single client against a large corporation. Legal proceedings are not, technically speaking, negotiations, since they're regulated by legal factors that don't affect true negotiations, but my point stands. The corporation is in a position to drive up the endurance, whereas the lawyer does not have this capability. It's not a fair fight in this regard. I say this without taking a position on the controversial subject of torts litigation. Therefore, some consumer products companies have a policy of refusing to settle lawsuits. They'll spend $100,000 in legal fees instead of settling for $20,000, figuring that this announced policy keeps the suits to a minimum and saves money in the long run. And I'll bet they're right. In any event, if you're a lawyer, you'd want to know about this policy beforehand, wouldn't you? Do your research. If you're negotiating with a big multinational, wouldn't you want to know that they have the habit of driving up money budgets by insisting on meetings all over the country and often the world? This tactic of driving up the dollars and cents budget of their smaller suppliers is basic strategy for the purchasing departments of the big multinationals. It works to perfection against win-win, of course, but the supplier who's using the CAMP system doesn't lie to himself about the situation. He just sees it clearly, sets the money budget, and is prepared to lose every dollar of it. In this way, the supplier protects himself from needing and from compromise as the crunch approaches. The professional negotiator engages in an ongoing assessment of the money budget at all times. If you don't have enough cash reserves for the long haul, your negotiation is, for all intents and purposes, over with before it even gets going. So don't even get going. Seek your deals elsewhere. The four CAMP clients who flew to Ireland for a meeting, where they were promptly stood up, lost $20,000. But the money was in their budget, and they had no expectations. How's this for trying to drive up the budget? My client was ready to ship two systems to their biggest customer, a giant multinational. These were special order systems, state-of-the-art work worth several million dollars apiece, with hard POs. And when the customer's truck backed up to the loading dock, my client was ready to roll out the machines. Imagine their surprise when the truck driver announced that he had specific orders not to pick up the two main systems. He'd been authorized to pick up only another subsidiary component. That's hardball for you. The multinational was hoping to get a literally last-minute discount, but two can play that game. On the telephone, then and there, with the truck driver waiting, officers with my client took an aggressive stand, reminding high officers with the multinational that this was a confirmed deal based on a long negotiation, and stating clearly that they needed a ship-in-place letter. This is a legal document that gives one party the right, for accounting purposes, to move an asset off the books of one company and onto the books of another. My client got that ship-in-place letter because they were entitled to it. Some years back, I was introduced to a young man named Craig Lemkuhl. Craig had just left the building industry as a contractor in order to join the real estate industry as a commercial broker. He had a family, and like many young family men, he had very little money, but he was committed to training in negotiation. Craig was scraping the bottom to pay for his training, and as he told me later, I wasn't about to waste my money by not applying the system. My newest client got his big break 3 months into our work when he had the opportunity to earn a substantial six-figure commission. During our coaching sessions and system studies, Craig had never missed a beat. He learned by leaps and bounds, but it was not until the last negotiation session with his adversary in this deal that he learned just what the value of money means to a negotiation. Everything. In the bitter end, money is the toughest business decision. I'll let Craig tell his own story. I'd spent a lot of time working on this deal, including a trip to the lender in Southern California. That was valuable, but the airfare alone was more than I could afford. All in all, I was reaching my budget, and my emotions seemed out of control. This was the biggest deal of my life. If I pulled this off, I'd make more than I made in all my working life. But in Southern California, the closing agent informed me I was $50,000 short. Try as I might, I had no way of throwing this sum of money into the pot. I saw my commission going right down the toilet. I didn't think we had a chance of doing the deal. I couldn't see the seller putting in any more money. I had a problem. Actually, I had two problems. First, I didn't understand the price of this negotiation to the seller, and second, I couldn't see him writing a $50,000 check. So, with my heart jammed into my throat, I returned to the seller and told him, in my most not-okay way, that two major problems had killed the deal. First, the deal was $50,000 short. Second, I didn't have the heart to ask him to throw in more money. His $200,000 contribution had moved the deal this far, and I couldn't ask him to throw in an extra $50,000, could I? What happened next was amazing. It happened so quickly. He simply asked me if another $50,000 would really close the deal. I was so emotional I didn't even realize he had asked the question. I just said, yes. He didn't blink an eye. Just opened his desk, took out a large checkbook, and handed the check to me with a smile, and said he was very happy. He'd been prepared to write a much larger check. He explained that his losses could have been much greater. He'd invested so much in this negotiation, he just wasn't going to lose this deal. I was shocked. It hit me like a ton of bricks. The money he'd already spent made the negotiation so valuable he couldn't let it go away. You must know your own budget for money, and as Craig learned, you must know your adversary's budget as well. Quite a few years ago, one of my very best students was conducting what was shaping up as the largest negotiation in the history of his company. At that time, the largest negotiated deal to date had been $1.2 million. This deal might come in at something way over $9 million. It would be difficult, but the company's decision-makers determined that there were adequate resources to take on such a large project and the negotiation it would entail. Given the green light, this young man burned the midnight oil, structuring his mission and purpose, his goals and objectives. Picture yourself in this situation. You struggle and lose sleep. Your life becomes more intense. Your commitment to the project grows, and soon the boss is putting the fate of the company in your hands. We're counting on you. You're the guy. You're the man. The only one who can pull this off. As the energy and time escalate in this negotiation, problems arise. Colleagues are getting in the way. If you're successful in closing the deal, they'll be under a great deal of additional pressure to perform in their jobs. They say they want you to win, but they're also afraid you will. You need their support, and they pledge to be there, but the work you ask of them comes in late or poorly done or not at all. Now you're afraid to let anyone else get involved. You're beginning to feel very alone. Your own budget for time and energy is getting high, but you must continue. Even under all these pressures, the energy you've already spent is also the energy driving you forward. You do a great job negotiating. 80 different mini-agendas in all, the subject of Chapter 12. Well over a dozen solid presentations to various teams of adversaries. A firm and welcome no heard at least 10 times. You can smell victory. You're prepared to make what you hope will be the final presentation. And then the boss says he's awfully proud of you, but he's decided to take over the negotiation himself. The man in the corner office is stepping in, and you won't be needed any longer. Unbelievable. But what can you do? What do you feel? Relief? Not a chance. You're a player. Disappointment? Worse. You're mad as hell. You've set the whole thing up, and now he'll probably lose the deal. He's not a trained negotiator. Predictably, the untrained boss's presentation is a joke and a disaster. He doesn't know the system established by his negotiator, you, and he ignores the one briefing he gets from you. His presentation of features and benefits is beside the point and of no interest to the other side. He makes everyone on the adversary's board who's sitting in on the presentation feel un-okay. And guess what happens? He's called the day after the presentation and told that the adversary has no interest in his company's providing the required services. It's over. What did my client do now in real life? He kept negotiating. He didn't quit. He didn't yell. Quite simply, he controlled his emotions and stayed in the system. The adversary may have been disgusted with his boss, but the deal wasn't dead. He knew this because he knew that while he'd spent a great deal of time and energy and money, the total price was still within the budget. Just as important, he knew that the budget for his adversary was also very high by this time. He knew their pain intimately. He made the calls, he wrote the letters to bring everyone back to the table, and he soon closed the deal. And who tried to take all the credit in the end? Who else? The moral of this story: if you know the price and manage your time and energy and money and stay within budget and serve your mission and purpose, you're okay regardless of what the boss does. The emotion budget. The thrill of victory. The agony of defeat. I'll bet you recognize those words almost immediately because they become cliches in our culture, thanks to ABC's Wide World of Sports. I still remember the ski jumper whose goggles fly off as he crashes over the side of the ski jump, and the American hockey team celebrating their unbelievable victory over the Soviet squad back in 1980, when the United States and the USSR were bitter adversaries. And when it comes to my son's college football games, I know all about thrill and agony. For sports fans, these extreme emotions are fine. They're mandatory for the fun. For negotiators, they're dangerous. I'll stick by my original calculus. Time is 1x, energy is 2x, money is 3x, and emotion, 4x. Emotions have an extremely high value in any negotiation. The value of the negotiation increases by many multiples when emotional pain or excitement is invested. The reason money is the toughest business decision is that money issues are also emotional issues for most of us. I guess there are people who don't care about money, but will you find them in the business world? The excitement of winning and the pain of losing, of failing, are the two key emotions for both you and your adversary, and sophisticated corporate negotiating teams are trained to drive up your emotional budget, as well as the other two budgets, of course, with promises, threats, ridiculous requests and deadlines, sudden exclamations that the deal has gone south, and the like. But you must control your needs, your positive and negative expectations, your fears, your ego, your responses, and your decisions. You must not expect to manage the actual wins or losses, because you can't do this. You can only manage the means to the end. Stay within your system. Manage your activity. Manage your behavior. This is all the armor you need. At the same time, you build needs, expectations, fears, and egos in the adversary in order to increase the value of the negotiation for him. Know your budget, control your budget. Know their budget, build their budget. These rules apply for time and energy, for money, for emotions. And when you master them, you really can't fail.